As that business tapered off, Freeman found himself spending more time every day explaining to customers how to operate a digital camera and how to process and touch up film digitally using computers. Some days, he told me, he would be exhausted by 5 p.m., yet realized that he had not really gotten anything done on his core business. He was spending all his time explaining to customers or his own employees the fine points of digital photography and processing. So, Freeman recalled, one day he finally said to himself, "Since I am spending half my time explaining digital photography, I might as well make it half my business." In early 2006, he ripped out of his shop the big print processors that he used to make enlargements of slides and replaced them with a dozen computers, mostly Apple Macs, and an array of digital printers. He and his staff started using the computers not only for processing customers' digital photography, but, more important, to start a new career as explainers. They invited potential clients to come in during office hours or after and learn, for a fee, how to do sophisticated digital photo processing, retouching, and manipulation using the latest computer software. They also offered to teach at a client's home or office computing environment, so the information could be applied immediately on the client's own digital photo systems. "We used to sell film and develop and print the pictures and give away the advice for free," explained Freeman. "Now we are selling the advice and, while not giving away the products, they have become a smaller part of our business. We are going to make explaining the business." In light of that, Freeman told me he has had to think about his staff in different ways. The pure backroom technical person who does not have good people skills might be less in demand, and the good people person who might be just one chapter ahead of the clients in terms of understanding digital photography becomes more valuable because he or she is a really good explainer. The Great Leveragers. The man who invented information technology outsourcing is Ross Perot, the fast-talking Texan who ran for president in 1992. After his discharge from the Navy in 1957, Perot went to work as a salesman for IBM, where he identified what he thought was a unique business opportunity. Using downtime on one company's computers, back when computers were uncommon and expensive, to do data processing for other companies. Perot left IBM in 1962 and founded EDS to do just that, winning contracts from large corporations and eventually the U.S. government. This has come to be known as business process outsourcing, and it has spread from Texas to Bangalore, thanks to the flattening of the world. EDS, which Perot sold in 1984, still does business process outsourcing today, competing with companies in India and across the world. In November 2005, I visited the EDS campus in Plano, Texas, a modern grass, glass, and steel compound with a massive structure called the SMC, Systems Management Center, at the heart of it. There is a viewing area for visitors with seats like a home theater. When you come in, the curtains are closed, and then suddenly they part, and laid out before you is a huge control room that looks like the NASA headquarters monitoring a moonshot. There are 7 massive wall-sized screens, below them smaller TV screens, and below them about 100 individual control pods with screens and dials in front of them. Today, only about 20 of those pods have people sitting at their controls, because today 20 people do the work that 100 people did a decade ago. The only way EDS can compete with low-wage India is by having one person work smarter and faster, rather than cheaper and harder. Those 20 people can really leverage every drop out of every new technology as soon as it appears. Taking in this scene, I had one question. Who are those 20 people down there, and how come they have not been automated or outsourced? Here's what I learned. When the SMC was built, those 100 people worked in shifts with constant eyes on glass, because when you are running other people's data, you cannot afford your computer systems or theirs to be even 99.999% operational. They have to be working perfectly all the time. Otherwise, a whole company's business processes could crash. So the SMC operators had to sit in those pods and constantly watch the information being spewed out on different screens by the EDS computers processing the data for all sorts of customers. You might see 1,000 informational messages and then one error message that you couldn't afford to miss. Some of the people who worked in the SMC didn't have college degrees, let alone computing expertise. EDS simply trained them to keep their eyes on the glass and raise an alarm when an error message appeared. So if you suddenly got a message, "Service unavailable," and the phone started ringing from the customer's headquarters, as an operator, your job was to swivel around among four different screens and try to correlate all the information on all the screens and figure out the root cause of the problem. Was it the router? Was it the server? And two different operators would respond differently and come up with very different answers. Over time, EDS was able to leverage more and more computing power and identify the root cause of any problem automatically. "Now the swivel chair is gone," my EDS guide explained, "and the screen simply has a message that says, 'The router has a problem.'" "That's great," you might be saying to yourself. "Now I need to be even less well-educated to get one of those 20 jobs." But the opposite is true. The really special or specialized jobs at EDS are held by those people who can leverage technology, who can design precisely these computer programs that enable others to work smarter and faster. Those people are untouchables. The new middle jobs at EDS, for now at least, are held by the people who learn to operate these new programs. What does that involve? Today, the people sitting at the 20 pods are computer engineers, and smart ones at that. "The people we are looking for," explained the EDS futurist Jeff Wacker, "are people who can not only catch a problem, but quickly come up with a solution that will fix the problem for good so it will never happen again. Not only do they catch the fish, they fillet it and they reseed the pond. They see the problem, stop the problem, and then redesign the system so that that particular problem never, ever happens again. And it can't be a cowboy solution. It has to follow a standard protocol so that once you have fixed the problem and designed a better way of doing something, it is in a best practice format that can be applied throughout the EDS system or, better yet, sold to a customer. Now we need people who have a better understanding of how things tie together from end to end. But the end to end is not just from our computers to our customers' computers," said Wacker. "Now the end-to-end is our business and our customers' business and our customers' customers' businesses. We have clients who may have clients who may serve Dell's supply chain, so you have to have people who understand Dell and how it meets its business objectives for its customers. For instance, EDS works for a Canadian lumber company. To become more efficient, that company needs to implement technology systems so that even before a tree is cut down, the company knows whether it will be used for pulp or lumber, which mill will process it, which retailer will stock it, even the precise size of each piece of lumber that will come from it, and which building, home, or office it will be used to build. If EDS can help run the business processes of that Canadian company in a way that seamlessly integrates the buildings that architects are designing into the materials contractors are buying, into how that timber company cuts each tree, it will save everyone money, eliminate waste, lower transport costs, and make everyone more profitable. It's all about combining the best of what computers can do with the best of what humans can do, and then constantly reintegrating the new best practices the humans are innovating back into the system to make the whole, the machines and the people, that much more productive. There are lots of new middle jobs in that loop. The Great Adapters. The Gartner Group, the technology consultants, coined a term to describe the trend in the information technology world away from specialization and toward employees who are more adaptable and versatile. It calls them versatilists. Building employee versatility and finding employees who already are or are willing to become versatilists will be the new watchword for career planning, according to a Gartner study quoted by TechRepublic.com. The Gartner study noted that specialists generally have deep skills and narrow scope, giving them expertise that is recognized by peers but seldom valued outside their immediate domain. Generalists have broad scope and shallow skills, enabling them to respond or act reasonably quickly, but often without gaining or demonstrating the confidence of their partners or customers. Versatilists, in contrast, apply depth of skill to a progressively widening scope of situations and experiences, gaining new competencies, building relationships, and assuming new roles. Versatilists are capable not only of constantly adapting, but also of constantly learning and growing. Tech Republic quoted Joe Santana, director of training at Siemens Business Services. With flat or even smaller budgets and fewer people, managers need to make the most of the people they have. They can no longer see people as specialty tools. And their people need to become less like specialty tools and more like Swiss Army knives. Those Swiss Army knives are the versatilists. Let's face it, my kids have very little chance of working for the same company for 25 years as I have. They have got to be adaptable. Swiss Army knives. Gene Sperling, the former economic advisor to President Clinton and author of The Pro-Growth Progressive, also has a nice way of expressing this. He remarked to me that today's workers need to approach the workplace much like athletes preparing for the Olympics, with one difference. They have to prepare like someone who is training for the Olympics but doesn't know what sport they are going to enter, said Sperling. They have to be ready to do anything. If all that is true, then Marsha Lowry, the enterprise architect I met at EDS headquarters, is a gold medal Olympic adapter. She epitomizes for me the person who has adapted her way into the new middle, always staying just one step ahead of the job-devouring forces of automation and outsourcing. Sometimes I feel like it has been muddling instead of middling, remarked the good-natured 48-year-old adapter as she told me the story of her remarkable career path at EDS. I started out in 1978. I thought I wanted to be an accountant, so I was in college at the University of North Texas, but I was impatient to get on with my life, so I dropped out of college and went to night school, learned how to type and take shorthand, and I got a job in the EDS Word Processing Center. This was the days before PCs, so Lowry worked on a simple word processor, typing sales reports. After a few years, though, the PC came along on everyone's desk, and the sales reps typed their own reports. Goodbye to that job. So then I moved into mainframe and desktop publishing, she explained. That was slightly more specialized, and that involved formatting text to prepare documents for publication using computers. But then the software got more advanced and people could do that for themselves. Goodbye to that job. After that, Lowry made a living for a short time helping EDS colleagues learn how to do desktop publishing themselves. I automated the formatting process for people so they could publish their own documents, she said. From there, she took a job at the EDS call center and help desk. I was there for only about a year because while I was at the help desk, I realized that I would be a lot more successful at helping if I knew more about the network that we were supporting, she recalled. So I simply got up one day, put down my headset, and asked one of the top-tier people working in the SMC, Systems Management Center, Sam Billings, "How can I learn what you do? Sam, teach me." And he did. He would let me observe what he was doing. He'd reach under his desk and pull out a manual and say, "You need to know this." When he was troubleshooting a problem, he would take me over to a network diagram and say, "Let's use some logic here. You are getting a bunch of calls from people who have this symptom. What does it mean? Connect the dots." While she was going through this phase, Lowry realized that she needed to package and promote herself and compete as an individual against other individuals inside EDS. There were a lot of people who knew about technology, so what was going to differentiate me or make me get that new job as opposed to someone else? She asked. I concluded that I needed to keep constantly learning because there was always something new coming around the corner. That's when I understood that I was Marsha Incorporated, I concluded that I was solely responsible to keep learning by myself, that the resources were available, and that it was just a matter of me taking the initiative. But I decided that I needed some credentials. At the time, EDS was using Novell NetWare as its primary network operating system. Lowry, studying on her own, got herself certified on that system. On weekends, she would come in and just hang out with the engineers when they were rolling out a new server. They were so willing to help me, I guess because they recognized the curiosity factor, so I got some practical hands-on experience, she recalled. One day, one of the managers called me and said, "This system management center is growing rapidly." He said he had 5 openings and I should pick one. I picked Windows NT, Microsoft's network operating system, and I became one of the first NT server technicians in the SMC. So I helped to develop a team of people who did that support. Then I started tagging around with some of the systems architects. I was going to school the whole time and switched over to web-based courses. I eventually moved into engineering. Along the way, she also wrote a guidebook, Active Directory for Dummies. That, said Lowry, was a calculated move to try to raise my profile within EDS. I needed to prove that there was more to me than just the eyes-on-glass technician, and I wanted to prove that I could compete with the big guys and breathe some of their rare air. Because to get to the highest job codes, you have to publish, initiate patents, and work on globally important projects. Today, Marcia Lowry has reached the second highest technology rung at EDS, Enterprise Architect. Lowry, a single mom, said her son is a Marine reservist who recently returned from a tour in Iraq. "I tell him a lot, but I don't know if he's really listening," she says, like a good mom. The deep technical skills around math and science are going to get you in the door, but they are not what are going to keep you there or make you wildly successful. The core competencies are just the entry-level requirements. What will keep you there is developing a broader view. Corporations are flattening as the world is flattening, and you have got to be able to see things from the businesses, the customers, and the market's perspective. You can't just be head down, eyes on glass. Looking down at each rung of the ladder that got her here, Lowry said, "They're all gone. Every job I have done has to some degree been automated or is being done at least in part by someone in India. Maybe what set me apart was sheer dogged determination. I love to learn, and there is so much available here to learn with." But Lowry knows even enterprise architecture could easily be done from anywhere. "I am not done adapting, not by a long shot," she said. "Sam told me way back, be an expert on 3 topics, but know that those 3 topics will always be changing. So I try to have something that is my core bread and butter right now, another topic closely associated with it, and then what I'm going to do next." Oh, I forgot to mention, Marcia still does not have her BA. She's been too busy adapting. "Right now I'm taking a geography course," she said with a chuckle. "I am close to having enough hours to graduate, but so far all my finance and tech courses don't add up to a BA.
The Green People. When 3 billion people from China, India, and the former Soviet Empire walk onto the Flat World platform in a very short period of time, and every one of them wants a house, a car, a microwave, and a refrigerator, if we don't learn how to do more things with less energy and fewer emissions, we are going to create an environmental disaster and make our planet unlivable for our children. So there are going to be a lot of jobs involving the words sustainable and renewable. Renewable energies and environmentally sustainable systems. This is going to be a huge industry in the 21st century. As Carlotta Perez puts it, the more China, India, and other developing or ex-socialist countries industrialize, the bigger the environmental problems and the larger the market to prevent, moderate, or overcome them will be. Not only will the further development of these big countries generate the need for these industries, added Perez, but also stringent global regulation will create the conditions for them to emerge. Steve Jurvetson, the venture capitalist and innovator who has focused recently on the idea of clean tech investing, talks about what he hopes will be a biological renaissance,
A new era in which college students, instead of becoming doctors, might instead focus on bio-derived or bio-inspired solutions to our looming energy and environmental problems. There are going to be a lot of jobs there. The Passionate Personalizers. Ann and I share season tickets to the Baltimore Orioles with friends. As anyone who attends games at Camden Yards knows, there is a guy there who sells lemonade in the lower deck who has perfected a dance routine around how he shakes and prepares the lemonade. He does a little jig and then high-fives you before he hands you the drink. I love to watch him operate because all he is selling is water with sugar and a lemon in a plastic cup. It couldn't be more of a commodity. It couldn't be a more vanilla job. Yet I always notice that by the end of the game, he is carrying around a wad of bills and tips that is thicker than that of any other vendor I see. Why? Because he took a simple vanilla task and gave it a personal touch, his own chocolate sauce, whipped cream, and cherry on top that made him special. I could get lemonade from plenty of vendors. I could also drink Coke or water, and he knows it. But I and others often shell out $3.50 plus a tip for his sugar water with lemon because it both quenches my thirst and puts a smile on my face. His something extra gives me something extra. Now, the lemonade man was already an untouchable in the sense that his job was anchored in Baltimore. He was providing a localized service that could not be done as well by a machine or someone in India, because he was delivering lemonade to my seat so I wouldn't miss a pitch. I would argue, however, that he has made himself something more. He elevated himself into the better-paying new middle by adding a personal, intangible dimension to his vanilla work. Sometimes that personal dimension is pure passion. Sometimes it is pure entertainment. Sometimes it is a creative touch that no one else thought of adding. But what it always does is take a routine task and upgrade it into a new middle job. There is an elderly African-American woman who makes coffee at the Caribou Coffee Outlet near my office on K Street in Washington. Every time I am in there, she goes out of her way to be helpful and ask me about myself. Not in a phony, overtrained way, like the staff at a Ritz-Carlton, but in a sincere way that I find charming. So I go out of my way to get my coffee there. One day, they're going to make her the manager, if she isn't already. Interestingly, the Princeton economist Alan Blinder argues in his paper on outsourcing that because so many new middle jobs will require a kind of personal touch, it may actually produce a revival in human interactive skills, skills that have atrophied to some degree because of the industrial age and the internet. The renewed stress on personally delivered services by humans as opposed to impersonally delivered services by computer-generated voices or voices from India, writes Blinder, may lead to just the opposite of the phenomena that Charlie Chaplin parodied so effectively in modern times. Human beings are social animals who enjoy human contact. In many past decades, it looked as if modern economic life were conspiring to minimize the volume of natural human contact that takes place on the job. In future decades, as personal services come to be more predominant, that trend seems likely to reverse, possibly leading to less alienation and greater average job satisfaction. The Great Localizers. While big business is certainly important for creating middle-class jobs, the fact is that small and medium-sized businesses really do the majority of hiring and firing. When those small and medium-sized businesses are growing and hiring people, the economy is robust. And when they are not, it is in recession. So if there is to be a new middle, small and medium-sized businesses must play key roles. What is exciting and encouraging about the flattening of the world and innovations like the business web is the degree to which they give small business so much more power and so many more cost savings to innovate and compete globally. Joel Cawley, the IBM strategist, calls this localizing the global. As he puts it, There's going to be a huge amount of business for those small and medium-sized firms that learn how to take all the global capabilities that are now out there and tailor them to the needs of a local community. It's the localization of the global, and we're just at the beginning of it. It has enormous potential to be very job-creating. Those who are successful at this will understand the emerging global infrastructure and then adapt all the new tools it offers to local needs and demands. This is going to create a lot of new middle jobs. The localization of the global will be the freelancer who finds a way to use a satellite dish, a DSL line, a BlackBerry, a PC, or some new software to become a book editor or a film editor or an eBay entrepreneur from his or her bedroom. It will be the sports bar owner who learns to use multiple satellite feeds on multiple flat-screen TVs to bring 12 NFL games at once, plus a golf tournament in Europe, a basketball game in China, and a soccer match in Australia to his bar patrons on Sunday afternoons. It will be the coffee bar that is able to keep customers in their seats much longer by offering free wireless connectivity. It will be the small-time entrepreneur who understands that he can now hire Amazon.com to provide a global logistics infrastructure to manage his sale of customized book plates, and who understands he can go online and find a company in China that will make those book plates, and who, therefore, overnight becomes an importer of book plates for bookstores, all sold online. It will be the person who opens up a UPS store and becomes overnight a global supply chain manager for other small businesses. It will be the local auto repair shop that suddenly discovers that it can get cheaper BMW hubcaps and Mercedes windshield wipers from a supplier in Romania than one in Rochester. Finally, it will be people in all sorts of businesses and industries who understand the power of modeling. And I am not talking about Cindy Crawford. Using computer simulation and graphics, you can now bring all sorts of data together to create models that will show you how all kinds of complex things work together before you actually go through the expensive process of building them. As a realtor who learns how to model, you can show prospective buyers the floor plan of a house or apartment and let them move walls around wherever they like. As an engineer who learns how to model, you can do the same with bridges and roads. So those landscape architects, financial planners, home designers, and real estate brokers who get it, who become skilled at working with clients who build, customize, and interpret models, will also find themselves with a pathway to the new middle. These are broad categories, and new ones will surely be constantly emerging. And there are certainly no hard and fast boundaries between these different strategies either. Often people will mix and match them. So let me leave you here with one last example. My childhood friend, Bill Greer, whom I think of now as a great adapter, localizer, and personalizer. He has drawn on all three strategies to secure a place in the new middle. Greer is 50 years old and has made his living as a freelance artist and graphic designer for 28 years. From the late 1970s until right around 2000, the way Bill did his job and served his clients was pretty much the same.
Clients, like the New York Times, would want a finished piece of artwork, Bill explained to me. So if he was doing an illustration for a newspaper or a magazine, or proposing a new logo for a product, he would actually create a piece of art, sketch it, color it, mount it on an illustration board, cover it with tissue, put it in a package that was opened with two flaps, and have it delivered by messenger or FedEx. He called it flap art. In the industry, it was known as camera-ready art because it needed to be shot, printed on four different layers of color film, or separations, and prepared for publication. It was a finished product, and it had a certain preciousness to it, said Bill. It was a real piece of art, and sometimes people would hang them on their walls. In fact, the New York Times would have shows of works that were created by illustrators for its publications. But in the last few years, that started to change, Bill told me, as publications and ad agencies moved to digital preparation, relying on the new software, namely Quark, Photoshop, and Illustrator, which graphic artists refer to as the Trinity,
which made digital computer design so much easier. Everyone who went through art school got trained on these programs. Indeed, Bill explained, graphic design got so much easier that it became a commodity. It got turned into vanilla ice cream.
In terms of design, he said, the technology gave everyone the same tools, so everyone could do straight lines and everyone could do work that was halfway decent. You used to need an eye to see if something was in balance and had the right typeface, but all of a sudden, anyone could hammer out something that was acceptable.
So Greer pushed himself up the knowledge ladder. As publications demanded that all final products be presented as digital files that could be uploaded, and there was no longer any more demand for that precious flap art, he transformed himself into an ideas consultant. Ideation was what his clients, including McDonald's and Unilever, wanted. He stopped using pens and ink and would just do pencil sketches, scan them into his computer, color them by using the computer's mouse, and then email them to the client, which would have some less skilled artists finish them.
It was unconscious, said Greer. I had to look for work that not everyone else could do, and that young artists couldn't do with technology for a fraction of what I was being paid. So I started getting offers where people would say to me, can you do this and just give us the big idea? They would give me a concept, and they would just want sketches, ideas, and not a finished piece of art. I still use the basic skill of drawing, but just to convey an idea. Quick sketches, not finished artwork. And for these ideas, they will still pay pretty good money. It has actually taken me to a different level. It is more like being a consultant rather than a Jaffa, just another fucking artist. There are a lot of Jaffas out there, so now I am an idea man, and I have played off that. My clients just buy concepts. The Jaffas then do the art in-house or it gets outsourced. They can take my raw sketches and finish them and illustrate them using computer programs, and it is not like I would do it, but it is good enough, Greer said.
But then another thing happened. While the evolving technology turned the lower end of Greer's business into a commodity, it opened up a whole new market at the upper end, Greer's magazine clients. One day, one of his regular clients approached him and asked if he could do morphs. Morphs are cartoon strips in which one character evolves into another. So Martha Stewart is in the opening frame and morphs into Courtney Love by the closing frame. Drew Barrymore morphs into Drew Carey. Mariah Carey morphs into Jim Carey. Cher morphs into Britney Spears. When he was first approached to do these, Greer had no idea where to begin. So he went on to Amazon.com and located some specialized software that would empower him to create morphs, bought it, tried it out for a few days, and produced his first morph drawings. Since then, he has developed a specialty in the process, and the market for them has expanded to include Maxim magazine, More, and Nickelodeon, one a men's magazine, one a middle-aged women's magazine, and one a kids' magazine. In other words, someone invented a whole new kind of sauce to go with the vanilla, and Greer jumped on it. This is exactly what happens in the global economy as a whole.
I was experienced enough to pick these morphs up pretty quickly, said Greer. Now I do them on my Mac laptop anywhere I am, from Santa Barbara to Minneapolis to my apartment in New York. Sometimes clients give me a subject, and sometimes I just come up with them. Morphing used to be one of those really high-end things you saw on TV, and then they came out with this consumer software program, and people could do it themselves, and I shaped them so magazines could use them. I just upload them as a series of JPEG files. Morphs have been a good business for different magazines. I even get fan mail from kids.
Greer had never done morphs until the technology evolved and created a new specialized niche, just when a changing market for his work made him eager to learn new skills.
I wish I could say it was all intentional, he confessed. I was just available for work and just lucky they gave me a chance to do these things. I know so many artists who got washed out. One guy who was an illustrator has become a package designer. Some have gotten out of the field altogether. One of the best designers I know became a landscape architect. She is still a designer, but changed her medium altogether. Visual people can adapt, but I am still nervous about the future. I told Greer his story fit well into some of the terms I was using in this book. He began as a chocolate sauce, a classic illustrator, was turned into a vanilla commodity, a classic illustrator in the computer age, upgraded his skills to become a special chocolate sauce again, a design consultant, then learned how to become a cherry on top, a morphs artist, by using the new tools of the flat world to fill in a new market niche. Greer contemplated my compliment for a moment and then said, "And here all I was trying to do was survive, and I still am." As he got up to leave, though, he told me that he was going out to meet a friend to juggle together. They have been juggling partners for years, just a little side business they sometimes do on a street corner or for private parties. Greer has very good hand-eye coordination. "But even juggling is being commoditized," he complained. "It used to be, if you could juggle 5 balls, you were really special. Now juggling 5 balls is like just anteing up. My partner and I used to perform together, and he was the 7-ball champ when I met him. Now, 14-year-old kids can juggle 7 balls, no problem. Now they have these books like Juggling for Dummies and kits that will teach you how to juggle. So they've just upped the standard." The Right Stuff, Tubas and Test Tubes. In the past 2 years, I have had a chance to travel around America and speak about globalization and the flat world to many different audiences, from retirees in Palm Springs to high school principals in Bethesda to parents in suburban book clubs. What struck me most was the undertow of concern I found in the country around the issues of education and competition. If I had to summarize that anxiety, I would put it like this. Our parents were sure that they were going to be better off than their parents, and that we, their children, were going to be better off than they were. We, alas, are growing quite concerned that we are not going to retire as well off as our parents did, and our kids probably are not going to be as well off as we were. Everyone seemed to me to be looking for the magic formula that would spare their kids from a future of downward mobility. Twice I had parents ask me a question that went roughly like this. "My daughter is studying Chinese. She's going to be okay, right?" "Well," I would answer, "not exactly." "Why not exactly?" "Because there is no magic formula. The only approach to take in a moment like this one is to step back, take a deep breath, and ask, if the strategies detailed in the previous chapter really are the best way for individuals to obtain and retain jobs in the new middle, then, generally speaking, what is the right kind of education to prepare our young people for those jobs?" As Princeton economist Alan Blinder perceptively notes, "It is clear that the U.S. and other rich nations will have to transform their educational systems so as to produce workers for the jobs that will actually exist in their societies. Simply providing more education is probably a good thing on balance, especially if a more educated labor force is a more flexible labor force that can cope more readily with non-routine tasks and occupational change. But it is far from a panacea. In the future, how we educate our children may prove to be more important than how much we educate them." In this chapter, I focus on what I have learned from asking employers and educators this simple question. What is the right stuff? What is the right education young people need to prepare for the jobs of the new middle? What they shared with me were not specific courses you should take, but rather certain skill sets and attitudes. I will concentrate on 4 that will be important for anyone seeking a pathway to the new middle. The first and most important ability you can develop in a flat world is the ability to learn how to learn, the ability to constantly absorb and teach yourself new ways of doing old things, or new ways of doing new things. That is an asset every worker should cultivate in an age when parts or all of many jobs are constantly going to be exposed to digitization, automation, and outsourcing, and where new jobs and whole new industries will be churned up faster and faster. In such a world, it is not only what you know, but also how you learn that will set you apart. Because what you know today will be out of date sooner than you think. During a talk I gave in St. Paul, Minnesota, I made this point, and at the question and answer period afterward, a young man in the balcony raised his hand, identified himself as a ninth grader, and asked, "Mr. Friedman, if it is that important to learn how to learn, how do you learn how to learn? What course should I take?" From the mouths of babes. It's a logical question. At the time, I had not thought it through in detail, so I ad-libbed an answer, which I think is in the right direction. Go around to your friends and ask them just one question. Who are your favorite teachers? Then make a list of those teachers and go out and take their courses, no matter what they are teaching, no matter what the subject. It doesn't matter whether they are teaching Greek mythology, calculus, art history, or American literature. Take their courses. Because when I think back on my favorite teachers, I don't remember the specifics of what they taught me, but I sure remember being excited about learning it. What has stayed with me are not the facts they imparted, but the excitement about learning they inspired. To learn how to learn, you have to love learning, or you have to at least enjoy it, because so much learning is about being motivated to teach yourself. And while it seems that some people are just born with that motivation, many others can develop it or have it implanted with the right teacher or parent.
Navigation.
Second, we need to think more about how we teach navigation skills. As the world flattens out, more and more knowledge, information, news, software, commerce, and communities will reside on the World Wide Web. Our children will interact with each other, with the wider world, and with all that resides on that web without many filters. Therefore, teaching them how to navigate that virtual world and how to sift through it and separate the noise, the filth, and the lies from the facts, the wisdom, and the real sources of knowledge becomes more important than ever. When the web first emerged, I used to joke that if I had one fervent wish, it would be that every modem sold would come with a warning label from the Surgeon General that would say, "Judgment not included." In May 2002, I sat with 20 thoughtful young Indonesians in the garden of the Pondok Pesantren Darunaja, one of Jakarta's finest Islamic boarding schools, to ask them for their views of America. I wanted to understand how the world's largest Muslim nation was reacting to September 11th and the Middle East crisis. I could tell you in my own words, but let me instead run the tape of my chat with the most articulate student, an 18-year-old girl.
"Most Muslims are afraid of America because they think America is against Islam," she began. "You can see that America is backing the Israelis, and the enmity between Islam and Israel, the Jews, and Judaism is obvious. It is not that Americans are afraid of Muslims, but that Muslims are afraid of Americans. As for the September 11th tragedy, we can't prove that Muslims did it, because up to now, they have not found evidence to prove that bin Laden is the one who did it. Also, I read in some newspaper that the real people who did that tragedy are Americans. I don't know what percent of the Congress are Jewish, but America is backing Israel, and I think therein lies the feeling of enmity toward America."
"What do you think of President George W. Bush?" I asked her.
"At the beginning, when George Bush became president, some people thought he is only going to be like his father, and he's not going to make anything new. And also, people did not want Al Gore to win because he was Jewish. So people said, okay, George Bush is better. He promised a lot of really good things, but has not realized them up to now."
She was absolutely certain Al Gore was Jewish. "Where do you get your news?" I asked her.
"I get most information from the TV," from the internet, too. I really like to read the online Arabic magazines because they give a different point of view. If I read Indonesian magazines, they don't have a lot of information about Muslims and Islam. I always think of that young woman as someone who lacked, among other things, navigation skills, the ability to sort out truth from fiction in this open sewer of information, facts, insights, lies, and half-truths called the World Wide Web. How many times have you heard someone say, "But I read it on the internet," as if that should settle the matter? Because the internet comes with a patina of technology, things that are read there, particularly by those without navigation skills, seem more believable. There is a great line in the Robin Williams movie Man of the Year, which is about politics, television, and a comedian, Williams, who runs for president. At one point, one of candidate Williams' aides remarks to him that the problem with television is that it makes everything and everyone seem credible. And when everyone is credible, no one is credible. A comedian debating an expert. Both seem equal. The same could be said of the internet. It makes everything seem equally credible to the uninitiated. So BBCNews.com says Al Gore is Christian on its website, and Jihad.com says Al Gore is Jewish on its website. On a flat screen, they both seem equal. In the Indian newspaper Daily News and Analysis, November 5, 2005, Sachin Kalbag, the paper's Washington correspondent, wrote the following, which caught my eye. "The web is undeniably the ultimate storehouse of information, a sort of Encyclopedia Britannica's Encyclopedia Britannica. So, you can be as sure to find the real reason for pigeons bobbing their heads as you can be 100% pukka about finding what colitas actually means in the hit Eagles song Hotel California. If you need to plagiarize something for your academic thesis or an office report, the web is there for you. It is as if we are giving rise to an army of instant masterminds, just like the 50-odd news channels on television have given rise to rent-a-minute experts on any topic. The result is that the same generation is in danger of growing up with 170 terabytes of knowledge and information, but not more than a few bits of wisdom. The challenge for the next generation of parents, educationists, and thinkers will therefore not be the dissemination of information, but to change the way people differentiate between information and wisdom. Indeed, the lines that divide the two have been blurred so much that information is often confused as wisdom. To be sure, navigation skills, judgment, and the ability to find wisdom and knowledge in the fire hose flow of information were always important. But they are more important than ever as the world flattens out and more people are getting their information from news sites that are not edited with the rigor of the New York Times or the BBC. As more people are asked to learn on their own in non-classroom settings, particularly online. As more people are generating their own content, blogs and podcasts, without conventional standards, and as more people interact with more other people whom they do not know and may never meet. We cannot stick our heads in the sand on this. Joel Cawley of IBM told me that at his daughter's high school, they forbid students to cite Wikipedia entries in footnotes of their papers. Cawley rightly disagreed with this policy. "They meant well. They thought they were teaching kids to be careful," said Cawley. "But what they were actually doing is missing an opportunity to teach them how to navigate, how to go about sorting and cross-checking facts wherever they might find them. We can't tell our kids to ignore the resources on the web, but we can and must teach them better how to navigate them." CQ plus PQ is greater than IQ. My third broad theme would be passion and curiosity.
It was, and always will be, a great advantage to have passion and curiosity for anything. But again, when the world is flat, curiosity and passion for a job, for success, for a subject area, or even a hobby are so much more important than they once were. Because in the flat world, you have so many more tools to take you and your curiosity so much farther and so much deeper. Doc Searles, senior editor of the Linux Journal and one of the most respected technology writers in America, spoke to this point in a review of the first edition of his book, April 28, 2005. He said, "In the new flat world, educational opportunities are limitless, even without help from school, government, churches, or business. Much of what you need to know about pretty much everything is out there on the web somewhere, especially if you're a technologist. Yes, the web isn't everywhere, but it's in all the flat places, and the flatness is spreading fast. Of course, the average and the dumb are still plentiful, no doubt about it. But try this concept on for size. Most of them were made that way. They were shaped in large measure by school systems that have had from the dawn of the industrial age a main purpose: to produce employees for boxed positions in corporate org charts that take the shape of pyramids, wide at the bottom and narrow at the top. There were few alternatives in the industrial age aside from farming and other relatively solitary occupations. But there are plenty of alternatives now, as many as there are individuals with access to broadband. For all these reasons, I have concluded that in a flat world, IQ, intelligence quotient, still matters, but CQ and PQ, curiosity quotient, and passion quotient, matter even more. I live by the equation CQ plus PQ is greater than IQ. Give me a kid with a passion to learn and a curiosity to discover, and I will take him or her over a less passionate kid with a high IQ every day of the week. Curious, passionate kids are self-educators and self-motivators. They will always be able to learn how to learn, especially on the flat world platform, where you can both download and upload. Work matters, said Searles, but curiosity matters more. Nobody works harder at learning than a curious kid. For my money, they could engrave that onto the doorway of every school in America. Nobody works harder at learning than a curious kid. Some kids are just born that way, but for the many who are not, the best way to make kids love learning is either to instill in them a sense of curiosity by great teaching, or to stimulate their own innate curiosity by making available to them all the technologies of the flat world platform so they can educate themselves in an enormously rich way. Consider this story from the New York Times Education Life Supplement, April 24, 2005. It was about Brittany Schmidt, a student at the University of Arizona, who was utterly bored with her courses, mostly because her professors seemed interested only in giving lectures and leaving. I was getting A's in all my classes, but I wasn't being challenged, and I wasn't thinking about new things, she told a Times reporter. One semester, though, Ms. Schmidt had to take a natural science course, and it turned out to have a great professor and teaching assistants who stoked her curiosity and lit a fire in her. I was lucky, she said. I took a class from somebody who really cared. The result? A scientist was born. Many more science courses later, Ms. Schmidt was accepted to graduate school at UCLA in planetary physics and at the University of Chicago in cosmochemistry. You can't light the fire of passion in someone else if it doesn't burn in you to begin with. Hillary Rooney, the principal of Laytonsville Elementary School in Maryland's Montgomery County, came up to me after a lecture one day and told me that what she looked for in hiring teachers was one simple thing: whether they loved kids. Because if you don't connect with kids, you will never be able to convey the material, she said. If you can't feel the music, you'll never be able to play the music. But if you love kids, she said, and you convey that, even if you don't really know that much about the subject you're teaching, they will be inspired by you, and they will go out and learn it themselves. I can teach anyone a strategy, but I can't teach a person to love kids. And you can feel it in a classroom as soon as you walk in, whether that teacher loves kids. Kids at the elementary level all love their teachers, but boy, you can see the teachers who love those kids back. They motivate those kids to keep trying to do their best for that teacher. The kids are really doing it for themselves, but if they see that teacher really cares, is invested in their learning, that child will never be turned off. That is what real learning is. Is it possible to generate your own high PQ, a high passion quotient for a subject, without a teacher or parent stimulating you? Of course. Just think back to when you were a kid and you got your first fire truck or doll or doctor's kit or astronaut's helmet, and you told everyone you wanted to be a fireman or a fashion model or a doctor or an astronaut when you grew up. That innocent passion for a certain job, without knowing the salary or the working hours or the preparation required, is what you need to get back in touch with. It's that childlike feeling of, I want to do that because I want to do that, and I don't have to explain why, that we all need to rediscover. To put it simply, you need to rediscover your inner fire truck. We all have one, and when you find it, you'll know it. Stressing liberal arts. Fourth, since one of the new middle jobs is great synthesizers, encouraging young people early to think horizontally and to connect disparate dots has to be a priority, because this is where and how so much innovation happens. But first, you need dots to connect. And to me, that means a liberal arts education. Liberal arts is a very horizontal form of education, which is to say, a flat form of education. It is all about making connections among history, art, politics, and science. Yes, we need to be more rigorous in training our young people in math and science, which are the building blocks of so much knowledge. But we also need to be vigilant in upholding the teaching of art and music and literature, because they too are essential for innovation. I like how Mark Tucker, who heads the National Center on Education and the Economy, puts it. One thing we know about creativity is that it typically occurs when people who have mastered two or more quite different fields use the framework in one to think afresh about the other. Intuitively, you know this is true. Leonardo da Vinci was a great artist, scientist, and inventor, and each specialty nourished the other. He was a great lateral thinker. But if you spend your whole life in one silo, you will never have either the knowledge or mental agility to do the synthesis, connect the dots, which is usually where the next great breakthrough is found. One of the best examples of that I can think of is the story that Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple Computer, told about himself in a commencement speech at Stanford University, June 12, 2005. I am honored to be with you today at your commencement from one of the finest universities in the world. I never graduated from college. Truth be told, this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. Today, I want to tell you three stories from my life. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why did I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed college graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife, except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We have an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother later found out that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would someday go to college. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford, and all of my working-class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was spending all of the money my parents had saved their entire lives. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with, and I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it, and much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand-calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would never have had multiple typefaces or proportionately spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something. Your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down, and it has made all the difference in my life. Steve Jobs' story underscores that the inspiration for technological breakthroughs is not always rooted in technological knowledge alone. Math and science are necessary, critically necessary, but they are not sufficient. I think one reason America has always been a leader in innovation of new products and services, from IBMs to iPods, is that our society has always valued both technology and liberal arts. In our justifiable desire to leave no child behind, we need to make sure that we don't leave art and music and theater and literature classes behind as well. It would undermine a critical source of our economic strength and our ability to generate good new middle jobs and the workers to fill them. As Mark Tucker notes, Those countries that produce the most important new products and services can capture a premium in world markets that will enable them to pay high wages to their citizens. But that kind of leadership does not depend on technology alone. It depends on a deep vein of creativity that is constantly renewing itself, and on a myriad of people who can imagine how people can use things that have never been available before, create ingenious marketing and sales campaigns, write books, build furniture, make movies, imagine new kinds of software that will capture people's imagination and become indispensable to millions. This is a world in which a very high level of preparation in reading, writing, speaking, mathematics, science, literature, history, and the arts will be an indispensable foundation for everything that comes after for most members of the workforce. It is a world in which comfort with ideas and abstractions is the passport to a good job, in which creativity and innovation are the key to a good life, in which high levels of education, a very different kind of education than most of us have had, are going to be the only security there is. A world in which routine work is largely done by machines is a world in which mathematical reasoning will be no less important than math facts, in which line workers who cannot contribute to the design of the products they are fabricating may be as obsolete as the last model of that product, in which software engineers who are also musicians and artists will have an edge over those who are not, as the entertainment industry evolves. A world in which it will pay architects to know something about nanotechnology, and small businessmen who build custom yachts and fishing boats will be able to survive only if they quickly learn a lot about the scientific foundation of carbon fiber composites. As I have said, India and China have provided large numbers of their young people with solid foundations in math and science, and it has been extremely important in their rise out of poverty. But it is no accident that when you talk to Indian and Chinese business people and even educators, some now openly express their concerns that if math and science are not leavened by art, literature, music, and the humanities, their countries will be at a competitive disadvantage as they try to get to the next level of global competition. Jerry Rao, the co-founder of Emphasis, the big Indian outsourcing firm, put it to me this way. We have no one going into the liberal arts and everyone going into engineering and MBAs. We are becoming a nation of aspiring programmers and salespeople. 50 years ago, the Sanskrit scholar was respected in India, Mr. Rao noted. But today, it is all about becoming an engineer, a programmer, an MBA, or a doctor. More people will get PhDs in the study of Sanskrit in America this year than in India, Mr. Rao asserted. And Sanskrit is the root of our culture. If we don't have enough people with the humanities, we will lose the next generation of V.S. Naipauls and Amartya Sens, he added, referring to the Indian Trinidadian author and the Indian economist, both Nobel laureates. That is sad and dangerous. Right brain. Finally, if creativity depends on connecting disparate dots, then we need to be educating our young people not only in more dots, a la the liberal arts, but also in the ability to think horizontally, to mesh together different perspectives and disciplines to produce a third thing. That skill is something that happens on the right side of our brains, and educators need to think about how we nurture that. Daniel Pink, author of A Whole New Mind, Moving from the Information Age to the Conceptual Age, explains.
Scientists have long known that a neurological Mason-Dixon line cleaves our brains into two regions, the left and the right hemispheres. But in the last 10 years, thanks in part to advances in functional magnetic resonance imaging, researchers have begun to identify more precisely how the two sides divide responsibilities. The left hemisphere handles sequence, literalness, and analysis. The right hemisphere, meanwhile, takes care of context, emotional expression, and synthesis. Of course, the human brain, with its 100 billion cells forging 1 quadrillion connections, is breathtakingly complex. The two hemispheres work in concert, and we enlist both sides for nearly everything we do. But the structure of our brains can help explain the contours of our times. Until recently, the abilities that led to success in school, work, and business were characteristic of the left hemisphere. They were the sorts of linear, logical, analytical talents measured by SATs and deployed by CPAs. Today, those capabilities are still necessary, but they're no longer sufficient. In a world upended by outsourcing, deluged with data, and choked with choices, the abilities that matter most are now closer in spirit to the specialties of the right hemisphere: artistry, empathy, seeing the big picture, and pursuing the transcendent. If you want to be sure that you are what I call an untouchable, argues Pink, a person with a job that a computer or robot cannot do faster or some talented foreigner cannot do cheaper, and just as well, you need to focus on constantly developing your right brain skills, such as forging relationships rather than executing transactions, tackling novel challenges instead of solving routine problems, and synthesizing the big picture rather than analyzing a single component. We're not all going to lose our jobs tomorrow, but as the cost of communicating with the other side of the globe falls essentially to zero, as India becomes, by 2010, the country with the most English speakers in the world, and as developing nations continue to mint millions of extremely capable knowledge workers, the professional lives of people in the West will change dramatically. If number crunching, chart reading, and code writing can be done for a lot less overseas and delivered to clients instantly via fiber optic cable, that's where the work will go. But those gusts of comparative advantage are blowing away only certain kinds of white-collar jobs, those that can be reduced to a set of rules, routines, and instructions. That's why narrow left-brain work, such as basic computer coding, accounting, legal research, and financial analysis, is migrating across the oceans. But that's also why plenty of opportunities remain for people and companies doing less routine work: programmers who can design entire systems, accountants who serve as life planners, and bankers expert less in the intricacies of Excel than in the art of the deal. Now that foreigners can do left-brain work cheaper, Pink argues, we in the U.S. must do right-brain work better. That, for me, is the key point. Now that foreigners can do left-brain work cheaper, we in the U.S. must do right-brain work better. In the last century, machines proved they could replace human muscle, added Pink. This century, technologies are proving they can outperform human left brains. They can execute sequential, reductive, computational work better, faster, and more accurately than even those with the highest IQs. Just ask chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, who lost a match to a chess-playing computer. To flourish in this age, we'll need to supplement our well-developed high-tech abilities with aptitudes that are high-concept and high-touch. High-concept involves the ability to create artistic and emotional beauty, to detect patterns and opportunities, to craft a satisfying narrative, and to come up with inventions the world didn't know it was missing. High touch involves the capacity to empathize, to understand the subtleties of human interaction, to find joy in oneself and to elicit it in others, and to stretch beyond the quotidian in pursuit of purpose and meaning. Developing these high concept, high touch abilities won't be easy for everyone. For some, the prospect seems unattainable. Fear not, or at least fear less. The sorts of abilities that now matter most are fundamentally human attributes. After all, back on the savannah, our cave person ancestors weren't plugging numbers into spreadsheets or debugging code, but they were telling stories, demonstrating empathy, and designing innovations. These abilities have always been part of what it means to be human. It's just that after a few generations in the information age, many of our high-concept, high-touch muscles have atrophied. The challenge is to work them back into shape. But exactly how do you go about nurturing your right brain skills? The way you nurture your right brain is by doing something you love to do, or at least like to do, because if you do, you will bring something intangible to it, something out of your right brain, which cannot be easily repeated, automated, or outsourced. As Pink put it, the sorts of abilities that matter most now, it turns out, are also the sorts of things that people do out of intrinsic motivation. Relatively few people become accountants out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. But intrinsic motivation is what propels people to become creators and empathizers, to become designers and storytellers and counselors and consultants. This weekend, there will be accountants painting watercolors in their garages. There will be lawyers writing screenplays. But I guarantee you that you won't find any sculptors who on weekends will be doing other people's taxes for fun. In other words, there is a growing congruence between the sorts of things that people do because they love doing them and the sorts of things that confer economic advantage. And so, concludes Pink, when you hear your parents or your college graduation speaker telling you to do what you love, they are not giving you some syrupy pablum. They are giving you a survival strategy. Tubas and test tubes. So let's work backwards now just one more step. If the jobs of the new middle require you to be a good collaborator, leverager, adapter, synthesizer, model builder, localizer, or personalizer, and these approaches require you, among other things, to be able to learn how to learn, to bring curiosity and passion to your work, to play well with others, and to nurture your right brain skills, what does that mean specifically for education? Again, I am not an educator, so I come to this question with great humility. I am a reporter, though, and I can report that there are some real educators out there who have tried to address precisely this question head-on. I am actually quite excited by the amount of experimentation I have seen on college campuses as they try to design the right education for the new middle. I am going to focus on one school, Georgia Institute of Technology, based in Atlanta, to illustrate one thoughtful approach. G. Wayne Clough, Georgia Tech's president, had to rethink education in a flattening world out of sheer necessity. Clough took over as president in 1994. When I came to Tech as an awestruck freshman back in the 60s, Clough told me, they had this drill for the incoming students. They would tell us, look to your left, look to your right. Only one of you will graduate.